We started the open mic in 2013 to fill a need. The Gloucester Writers Center had built a large community of interesting and interested people. We had a full schedule of remarkable readers. What was missing was the chance to hear the people from our own community and to welcome new voices to join us. We wanted to give our audiences a chance to share their own work. Over the past year, the open mic has become a place for a wide variety of voices to be heard. In one night, you might hear a story about growing up in Gloucester, a child's poem about the environment, a piece of a memoir, and a poem about a notorious Lanesville drunk. We have heard a breadth of work unmatched in most forums. There is a generosity in listening, in respecting others' voices at the open mic. Over the past year, we have built a community which looks forward to hearing the progress of longer works, listens intently to the poems and stories of newcomers and old friends alike. It is on this readiness to welcome different voices that the community has continued to grow. The open mic has a democracy similar to public transportation. Any given month, one may find a teacher, a grandmother, a child, a musician, and our poet laureate all in the same room, sharing with each other, listening to each other. We have built our ranks by welcoming all ages, all classes, all stories. We welcome you to come add your voice. And the first voice, as often, is Miss Abigail Cook.
So at my school, each year the fourth grade does a report on a state. And this year I got Michigan. And part of the state report is we have to make up a slogan to advertise our state. And for mine, I wrote a limerick, and this is it. The state touches four Great Lakes and was where the second biggest cherry pie was baked. The land of Henry Ford, here you'll never be born to go to Michigan, the offer I'd take.
All right, next up we have Cindy.
Okay, I did not write this, but I like this. And it's just a real short haiku. There is no there when you get there. That's it.
There, when you get there.
Okay. I think. So I've been keeping a sort of day book this winter. Midwinter day book, and some of the pieces started turning into prose, fictional prose, as I went through. And so the concerns, things I've been mulling over, I've taken it rather than sort of observing poetic form, have started to move into prose, then into stories. So I'm just going to read two of those pieces. Hark, say the Mekons. Our imaginary daughters of memory never stop counting the spectral legions of second and removed cousins who chant liturgically within the genealogical church, while in the fourth pew to the unnecessary priest's left, a suburbanly entombed war veteran uncle nods off and on under wine-stained light. He, the distant, translucent cousins, and the motley crew of fellow parishioners, including kind, bitter, worn, and buoyant elderly, and less than half a dozen young families, each with well-groomed fathers wearing studiously dignified paternal faces from post-World War II family sitcom caricatures, are submerged in Easter lily and incense-scented musical embellishments from the disciplined, weary, matronly fingers of the immortal Marian organist. Human scale and the billions play tonight at the New World Public House, while a frustrated insurrectionist adjunct professor of literature and rhetoric from the local state university reads, in fits and starts, The Art of Digression and Telling It Straight, in the corner snug with a pint of stout. The first song in the half-empty pub ends with the singer-guitarist strumming an E minor chord, which reminds the adjunct of an inaccessible memory having to do with his father's hirsute younger days. Hair in waves, mustachioed face, mutton-chop cheeks, a Gretsch 6120 electric guitar or some sort, or more likely a cheaper knockoff, and The Ventures, though the adjunct himself, a guitar aficionado but poor player, knows full well that The Ventures began with Fenders, Jazzmaster, Stratocaster, and Precision Bass, before playing Mosrites on the influential Ventures in Space. The adjunct suddenly recalls that the memory also has something to do with December and Advent, and therefore Christmas. The memory is warm, the color of window light on wood. The memory, and it is obvious to the adjunct, also has something to do with why he likes this pub, this snug and this stout, in the late afternoon, especially in winter, either side of the solstice. As he remembers that Christmas is part of the memory, and that the memory has something to do with why he is where he is at this precise moment, he stands up and begins dressing himself for the bracing cold and wind that await him outside. He ties his scarf, puts on his knitted hat, struggles into his secondhand military coat, left, then right arm, and finally shoves the mittens his wife made for him over his hands. He'd paid for his drinks and had tipped as he went, 3 pints in all. He says goodbye to the bartender, waves towards the band, weaves through the standing patrons, and pushes the heavy door open to meet the cold. At the nearest intersection, he crosses the street heading toward the harbor and the meeting in the old library, now a satellite of the local community college, where he and other non-tenured teachers in area public schools of higher education will organize for better wages and benefits. 2 blocks from the pub, the inadequacy of the speech the adjunct has written for the occasion begins to dawn on him like a black sun rising as the sun sets behind him, casting shadows toward the library where he spent afternoons as a teenager, much as he spends afternoons at the pub now. The adjunct begins to imagine the dark light from the black sun alighting on each failure, the strained grandiloquence of the opening figure, something about mushrooms, spore-bearing fungal flesh, appearing then thriving in the charred remains of a forest fire, the awkwardness of the transition between his call for solidarity and his labored articulation of legal issues relevant to securing a collective bargaining agreement, the asymmetry of the confirmatio, some points elaborated delicately and supported with scholarly citation, others asserted stridently in a ham-handed attempt to elicit cheers from the assembled low-level academics. The backbone of the state-funded post-secondary system, which nobly bears the aspiration of working and lower-middle-class families in the Commonwealth. And finally, the embarrassing, half-hearted return to the many-branched mycelium and its fruiting body, the mushroom, in the peroration. At the bottom of the slowly sloping hill between the pub and the old library, facing the harbor's small spiky waves, glittering on the top, casting a small dark shadow, facing a single trawler returning past the breakwater towards its docks in the near cove, facing the bitter wind, he feels the black sun becoming again the chambers of his heart, the lobes of his lungs, becoming the flesh of his liver and pancreas, becoming especially his stomach, but also the coiled intestines and furrowed brain, and at its thinnest, most like light itself, the fine mesh web of his nervous system, and he decides that the speech is not half bad and will get the job done despite its imperfections. Thanks.
Hello. This poem is called A Star for Mr. Trays. Somewhere far away on a clear night, you can see the light of Mr. Trays' star. Ever the gentleman lends a helpful hand, no matter how small, he does what he can. Art his forte, genius his quest to preserve the best of this our Cape Ann. Music his pleasure, he measures his time, a Renaissance man with his feet on the ground. Local productions within his grasp, he stops by to see some of the cast. The sea his bulwark runs by his home, he sails the waters, the wind blows free. His wealth is mighty, his spirit too, he gives of himself, tried and true. Prejudice an enemy he views with disdain, an affront to civility and the dignity of man. Egalitarian, he flaunts only his grace, conversing with feeling in discourse of life. German is second language, Germany is second home, where he married the love of his life. Stars in the firmament on a clear night, you can see the lights, maybe once for him. So ends this poem, a little rhyme from time to time to please his kind soul. Thank you.
I want to share with you, keep me posted on the time, just two poems, but it was a big experience. It was a reunion in Donegal, Ireland, and it's called The Gathering. And 40 people came from my husband's family in America, and there were 160 in Ireland, and they hadn't really met many of them. Maybe we've met three of them. And so it was quite an experience, these gatherings, I think, for most people that are part of it. This is called Gathering at Glen Columkill. You see, we were overwhelmed, humbled, smaller in significance by comparison. We were found in the crowd among you. We were speechless, no longer isolated. No split between happiness and loss, no separation between us, cousin, sister-in-law, in-law, friend. We were drawn like the tide, as if the moon was full behind the highest hill, and the rain was the same all over, watering fields from the earth's water. We were blindsided by the light in the dark, finding our way at night by the stars and the lamps behind the window shades of warm small houses hugging the street. The next day, a rainbow covered the whole of Glen Columkill from the sea to the other side, a ring above and below the undiminished valley, higher than anything made of human hands. Overwhelmed by free-roaming rams and goats and the books written and those to come, the old music, by rousing steps to wake the dead, laughing at our ruses and stiff necks. Sins we beg forgiveness for, the long list for confession we wanted to stay, as if this was home. By the ancient tongue alive again in the throat, as if all the occupiers and tyrants were gone at last. Long reach of gathering arms and hold. Okay. This came again shortly afterwards. Clouds so full of sea. I stand at my second floor window behind, I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right, Sleveleg Range, looking toward the northwest in a dream. Gray clouds over the cliffs and mountains, north and south, linger like poetry lifted off the page into our eyes. Here, priests gathered people when immigrants were about to leave and conveyed them forth, mourning, knowing their return was unlikely. Along the way, I saw this, how the smaller stones marked the cultivation terraces and fields outlining the parcels for grazing. Now the rain falls down, the clouds so full of sea. Sheep near and far lie still in their curled woolly skins, shedding water like village roofs. This morning the sky turned from night to powder blue like Sean's eyes, and the peat, unveiled. Browns and greens with asleep. That's the first time I've read this publicly, so. With a steep slope. Rounded hills and leaning meadows marked with groves of trees and tall shrubs in pockets by the houses and near the angled formations. A double rainbow appeared like the one in the Rockies. It's all the loved ones looking down who came before. Thank you.
Hello. I'm a little embarrassed to read this poem, but since I'm only a little embarrassed, I guess I'll read it. But it's a little bit sort of intimate, and it may not actually make the cut. I don't know. But it's sort of a pre-spring fancy, I guess. It's to all of you, whomever you may be, I must tell you, I'm having an impulse, like a tidal river flowing home. The appetite of 1,000 baby birds waiting for the worm. Such desires that I must touch you everywhere, even there. I must kiss your kisses and trace your past and trace you past all fences here and here. Oh, so greatly find me at your door. You say welcome, and I say two or three or more. The aging season. The dying tree no longer reaches out to grow its seed. It has only roots alive to the matrix of memory, whose potency is stored in the thick sap blood. Kill the past and all its filthy suffering. I think I am old and tired as I am. How can I muster the strength to kill the future? It's infinite, yet concrete it rails. It wounds, and I, just seeing it coming, have no shield, no sword. A Buddhist said that seeds sown in the present shape the future. Of what account is my seed? I am impotent and barren as any fruitless planet. Kill the present, I'm dead. The workaday world. Most people are sensitive, but we get numbed by the hum and drum. We bury our sensitivity because it trips us as we plod along making do. Or it burns us, pointing out that things are so, so. Yes, it brands us, reminding us that we are more than flesh and blood. We are too sensitive for this workaday world, for this nose to the grindstone. Just put one foot in front of the other. I can't wait to get home and watch TV world. A man young and old, three, the mermaid. A mermaid found a swimming lad, picked him for her own, pressed her body to his body, laughed, and plunging down, forgot in cruel happiness that even lovers drown. William Butler Yeats. A dream of naked feet. Oh, I'm dragging in my boots. I am hurt and I am weary, wishing to be home where I could dream of naked feet and cool sea water lapping at the beach, or curling in like an impatient child, or crashing, angry, frothing at the mouth. It's all an excuse to get my feet wet. And the mermaid, what would she think of me standing in water to the waist? She couldn't see my sunken toes. Perhaps she would think I was part fish, too. Would she show herself, swim into the surf, wrap her tail around my hips, kiss me straight upon the lips? We could be lovers, and like Yeats made, she would hold me close and dive too deep. Thank you.
And this little piece that I'm going to read, sort of, I would get to a certain point in my work and then I'd stop and I'd write a little bit more about me as Sisyphus. For example, when I can't find the rock, it's like I couldn't find the cover. I knew I wanted to put the cover on the email I was going to send out. I could not find it. It was probably half an hour or more of searching on my computer. Where is the cover? So this is. The story of Sisyphus, which is the sort of cataloging of the issues that I was dealing with this morning. And I did get emails out to 10 people, maybe 11, and my target is 10 a day, and I figure by the end of the year I'll have 3,000 of them, right? Mm. Or is it 30,000? I can't remember. And I've been telling everybody, I'll tell you, this is only going to my 2,000 closest friends. Mm. So, the story of Sisyphus. Hi, my name is Sisyphus. The gods, whoever they are, have told me I have to push a huge rock up this mountain. Not only that, I have to do it over and over again. I can't take a day off. I think the only breaks I get are when it rolls back down. So here I am at the foot of the mountain. I mean, I don't really have a choice. If I try to escape to go somewhere else to just not do it, I'm sure they'll find me. And then what? Not good. So here I am, like I said. But I can't even find the bloody rock. They said it would be here. They said I would recognize it when I saw it. But I've been searching around for at least half an hour and no rock to be found. Stones, yes. Pebbles, yes. Boulders the size of Squam Rock that no one could push. But a rock that fits their description? Nowhere to be found. Wait. Here it is. But it looks awfully big. I'm kind of afraid I might go at this wrong and end up dead at the foot of the mountain. And I'm kind of hungry, too, so I think I'll take a little break and then do a few test drives before I tackle the whole mountain. I think this is a time for a WWJD question. Only instead of J, I'll use R, my good friend Robin, who has lots of experience in landscaping. Of course, I can't call her, but I can work on this and I can imagine what she'd say, like, what if I push it with my hands? No, she'd tell me. She'd tell me I'd be getting calluses if I went at it like that. I try lots of different approaches, and each time I have a little internal dialogue with Robin. I think I'm getting close to a good approach now, and the amazing thing is that it's beginning to be enjoyable? Maybe not quite that, but hey, in a way that I can exercise my muscles and my strength, who would have thunk? Now I got this bloody rock up a ways. Not far, really, but hey, I've got it moving. Better than sitting at the bottom feeling hopeless. I keep bringing other folks into my head. I even talked with one of the gods. Hey, what do you think I should do? That was actually my co-author. Is that what they call praying? And he was pretty helpful. Arrogant, of course. But I got some good suggestions. Now I'm rolling the rock, not fast, but pretty steady, and all of a sudden I think of Sarah, my fisherman friend. What would Sarah do? Well, of course, she would use a fishnet. Why catch one when you can catch a school? That just might be a good idea. It cheers me up as I move upwards and onwards, and maybe I can beat the rock down and have time to find a net. Yep, I've gotten to the top. I balance the rock carefully so that it won't start rolling right away. I get to the bottom and plenty of time to run to Gloucester and find a good-sized net. I won't get much sleep tonight, but hey, this is for the long haul. I mean the next 100 years, not just the next haul up the mountain. The next morning, I position the net around the rock and tie it to a tree a few hundred feet up the mountain. It's hard to haul up, but not nearly as hard as pushing it every step of the way. As the days pass, I find more and more limbs and outcroppings that I can tie the fishnet to, and the task gets easier and easier. I've got a pretty easy life now. I just hope they don't notice and pile a few more things on me.
I think it was last month Elizabeth asked me to read more stories about my mother. So this is something that I wrote when Sam was just about a year old. So it's about 6.5 years old. Wednesday, October 31st. Water main broken downtown. No laundry, no dishes, no baths for the kids. The water's brown. So dirty it leaves a ring in the bathroom sink. I can't make coffee. At the market, my mother tries to talk to everyone. She mistakes their wanting her to move her carriage for a more pleasant eye contact. She doesn't understand. At the checkout, the man looks at each thing, says its name, says its size. 28-ounce can of kitchen-ready tomatoes, rings it in, looks at the computer and reads what it says. 28 ounces, kitchen-ready tomatoes, artichokes, oats and more cereal. Market basket, shredded cheddar cheese, Martin's potato bread. It is the longest checkout. Sam is crying. My mother puts him on the conveyor belt. He is happy. I bag my groceries as they come down. The man doesn't turn the second belt on, and I have to reach for the tomatoes and the cereal and the cheese. My mother is minding Sam. She doesn't put her groceries up. By the time I notice this, the man behind her has his out, blue divider between his and mine. I pick Sam up and put her food where he was. The man puts a pen in front of Sam. He picks it up. He gives Sam the receipt to sign. The man looks at my groceries and wants to bag the rest. Sam is crying again. I ask the man to please ring her food in. He wants to bag. I ask again. I promise I can keep them separate. He yields. By the time he is done naming her food, it is almost all bagged. He tells her the total, $43. She only has $40. My card is already in my bag beneath the groceries. I dig it out, take her $40, pay for her food. On the way home, we stop for a cup of coffee. She digs in her purse for money to pay for it. I tell her it's my turn.
I'm gonna read two things. I got the title of this first one from a Buffalo Springfield song from 1966 by Stephen Stills, for what it's worth. America, I hurl at you my deepest blasphemy. I'm sick of NFL football. Your aging gladiators, their minds a hive of buzzing bees, each one of which has forgotten the address of any flower, read the sports page and don't understand a word. America, I won't eat your three square meals a day. I eschew right-angled food. Sugar cubes and granola bars are for people who still think we have a democracy. Leave me out of it. I've looked inside your food pyramid for King Tut's golden mask. All I found was a note on papyrus from Monsanto. Eat GMO corn and weep, suckers. Mother Nature works for us now. America, you can't buy me off with cheap natural gas or tax cuts. All my heroes have been kicked out of the Hall of Fame for protesting our new war against the latest country we don't understand, or for passing out copies of the Constitution within 500 feet of a school. Even if you send Miss Congeniality to sit on my lap, I won't play nice. America, keep your people afraid. It's good for business. Afraid of impoverished Pakistani boys bobbing their heads to the cadence of the Quran. Afraid of Mexicans trying to steal our good American jobs, like breathing in pesticides and working bent over all day in the sun. Afraid enough to build a billion-dollar jet plane that won't fly in bad weather, but works well enough to strafe, say, Boston or Berkeley. Once, your soldiers threw their medals over the fence. Now we hero worship them, a sure sign that we don't want to be one. America, you won't answer my letters. You don't return my calls. Even my smoke signals warning danger get lost in power plant smog. Your drones are taking pictures of my SOSs lined out in stones between the fracking wastewater lakes. Your drones are taking pictures. Analysts puzzle over the meanings. Saving only sycophants, societies often sink. Saturated on stupidity, surviving on spirit. This one's called The Pope's Harley. I don't know if you followed the news on this, but the Pope auctioned off his Harley a couple weeks ago. And it went for $385,000. He autographed the gas tank. And his leather jacket, his Harley Davidson leather jacket, went for $75,000, also autographed. And he used the money to set up or support a soup kitchen in the Rome train station. The Pope's Harley. I heard it on the news today. The Pope auctioned off his ride. 1,600 cubic centimeters of chrome steel and American pride. They say he never rode it, and 'tis a pity if it's true. But I think of the other Francis and picture him with a Harley too, wearing his simple brown robe, facing his critics with a smile. I took a vow to embrace poverty, not one to forsake style. With birds perched on his shoulders, a tamed wolf by his side, he swings a leg over God's own lightning bolt. It's a Dyna Superglide. Brother to the sun and moon, a new ministry to begin. Oh, blessed V-twin engine, carry me far from sin. The unearthly heavenly rumble scares the rabbits and the toads. Brother Francis, at only half throttle, owns the 13th century roads. Who can guess his inner life or the way that he must feel, barreling home to Assisi on a wheel within a wheel, thanking every living creature and the grass up to its tips in full-throated contemplation with a prayer upon his lips. May God bless Mr. Harley and the son of David anew. Let us cruise the world in joyful praise and outrace the devil too. Back at the Holy See, Francis muses. The Vatican papers are filled with talk. The call of the open roads, not the only calling. The auctioned Harley will feed his flock. Thank you.
Next up, we have the illustrious Shep Abbott.
So I thought I'd take a chance at doing a couple of the songs, even though I don't have my guitar with me, but let's see. The West 24th Street Blues. That was a street I lived on in New York. My old friend called me up on the telephone line. He said, "How you doing?" He said, "Me, I'm doing fine." I said, "Me, I'm losing my mind." He said, "Yeah, me too." I said, "I thought you were doing fine." He said, "I am. How are you?" Well, I got the West 24th Street blues. I got the blues way down in my shoes. I got the mean old, green old West 24th Street blues. So I went down to the deli just to buy me a piece of fruit. Man behind the counter was wearing a brand new suit. I said, "You look good." He said, "You look good too." I said, "You're much too kind." He said, "I wasn't talking to you." Well, I got the West 24th Street blues. I got the blues way down in my shoes. I got the mean old, green old West 24th Street blues. Well, my baby come by just to make me feel good. She said, "Please don't cry." She said she understood. Well, I said, "Oh, baby, please don't go." She said, "So long, Frank. I thought you were Joe." Well, I got the West 24th Street blues. I got the blues way down in my shoes. I got the mean old, green old West 24th Street blues. This is not a song. A Gloucester legend. James Merry was a fisherman back in days of yore, but he left the blue in 92. For the trade of matador. So he raised a bull till it growed up full, and he learned the corrida lore. Then he died like a toad on the Dogtown Road, bleeding from a stomach gore. You guys know that story. Now this is my God poem here. God, I used to be a dog in my past life. I had a master who loved me. He gave me a warm, friendly home. He patted me and gave me hugs. He never failed to feed me and keep my water bowl full, and he gave me treats. He played games with me and took me on long adventures in the woods, where I would run like the wind through the trees, always returning to my master, who would be so proud of me, giving me more pats and hugs and treats. And when I became ill, my master would care for me and help me to recover. And when I was dying, my master was there to whisper loving words in my ear to comfort me. So if you want to know why I believe in God, it's because of this. I used to be a dog. Thank you.
I wrote this before I came to Gloucester. I used to live in Jamaica Plain. I lived in a triple decker there. And I would just write the stories of what would happen to me when I was there. This is called Cisco. It took me a long time to get close to Cisco. He was my neighbor's black cat who just didn't trust people. I talked to him frequently, but he always kept his distance. I got the feeling at one point in his life he wasn't treated well by humans. One night I got home late from the clubs, and Cisco was out patrolling the street. That night I sat down next to him on my porch, and we made a pact. I spoke to him as if he was another human. I told him I would come to his aid if he were ever being attacked by a dog in exchange for him protecting me from human predators late at night on the street. It was the beginning of a great relationship. Sometimes when my neighbors, Ann and Esther, would go on vacation, they'd leave Cisco in my care. We grew very close, and he would frequently visit me. He would sit on my porch next to my downstairs door and let out a loud siren-like meow if he wanted to be let into the house. He'd even sleep over semi-regularly. We developed a little tradition at bedtime. I'd be in bed and I'd lift the covers up for him. He'd go down around near my knees and then turn around and rub all the way up the side of my body, nestling into a comfortable spot beside my chest. He'd stay there for the whole night. One time after Ann and Esther's week-long vacation, Cisco refused to return to their house. I talked it over with them and agreed on sort of a joint ownership, letting Cisco stay wherever he chose. I went away for a couple of days, and when I returned, I didn't see Cisco at all. I was glad in a way that he was spending more time with his real owners. Then Ann called me and said Cisco was very ill. I went over to see him. Up on the third floor, he was back under a chair, kind of hiding from everyone. We got him out and took him to a vet. After an examination, the vet said Cisco must have ingested some antifreeze on the street. It was crystallizing his kidneys. The vet added that it was a quick degenerative situation. Cisco died right there at the vet. We took his body home and buried him in the backyard.